We're going to be spending this season in the book of Isaiah. You know, for these 4 weeks, really focusing on the four names that we're given in Isaiah 9:6. And then Christmas Eve, actually doing sort of a modified service of lessons and carols that's largely, largely from the book of Isaiah. But to understand where Isaiah 9 is coming from, to understand really where the entire book is coming from, to understand exactly how much these promises meant, we need to understand the context. We need to understand what Isaiah, early in his ministry, was dealing with. And it begins with the fact that the people of God were a house divided. And they had been ever since the death of King Solomon. Because in the later years of his reign, Solomon turned away from God and away from the faith of his father, King David. And so God pronounced a judgment on him that he was going to take the northern part of the land, the northern 10 tribes, away from the house of David. That he would spare Solomon to the extent that he wouldn't do it to him, but to his son and successor, Rehoboam. And so Rehoboam took the throne, quickly alienated most of the country, and the secession happened. The northern tribes became the kingdom of Israel, which was often referred to as Ephraim for its dominant tribe. The south became the kingdom of Judah for its dominant tribe. One people became two nations. And as is the way of the human heart, self-will and the desire for power and control turned that separation into rivalry and often enmity. And so we arrive, after many years, at the situation that we see in Isaiah 7, in the days of King Ahaz of Judah. Israel allied itself with Syria to the north to launch a plot against Judah. They had failed to conquer Jerusalem by force, and so they schemed to depose Ahaz from the throne of David and replace him with a Syrian puppet king. Now, anyone who took the word of God and God's history with his people seriously would have understood that God was never going to let that happen. Whatever might be said for Ahaz himself, which, to be honest, wasn't much, that would have violated every promise God ever made to David. There was no way that God was going to let that happen. And so, to reassure and encourage this king, and to remind him who he is, and who his God is, and what his nation is all about anyway, God sent Isaiah to tell Ahaz just to sit tight. Don't worry. Don't do anything. Nothing's going to happen. I've got this one. These are just a couple of burned out torches, and I'm going to take care of them. And it's an interesting thing. At the very end of his little speech that we have, Isaiah makes it very clear that this is not simply the king's best hope. It's his only hope. If you don't stand by faith, he says, you won't stand at all. And to confirm his promise, just to put a seal on the whole thing, God tells Ahaz, ask me for a sign. Ask me for anything. Anything in all creation. Anything you can think of. And I'll do it. just to prove my promise to you is true. Unfortunately, while Ahaz has spent his entire life around the worship of God, and no doubt has participated in a lot of services in the temple, he doesn't actually worship God where it counts. In our terms, we'd say he's one of those folks who's in church every Sunday, but yet he's not actually saved. And like a lot of folks like that, he's become adept at using the Bible and spiritual-sounding language to make excuses for not doing what God has explicitly told him to do. And in fact, he's gotten so good at that that he actually thinks he can pull that off on God's own prophet and get away with it. Well, he doesn't. Because you can't fool God like that. There's just no way. But he's determined to try because he doesn't want a sign from God. He doesn't want God's promise. He's already made up his own mind how he's going to deal with this situation. He's going to ally himself with the Assyrian Empire. Now, on the list of spectacularly bad ideas in human history, this one deserves a special place. I mean, this is the sort of idea that only a politician could think made any sense. Assyria was arguably the cruelest nation in human history. I mean, there are some contenders, you know, if you've studied the Incans, for instance, but seriously, they're right there at the top of the list. And I'm not going to go into that because I don't want people to start being physically ill in church. It doesn't really work very well. But suffice it to say, these people are about as nasty as you can think of. And at this point in time, they were on the rise. Their armies were conquering everything in sight. This is why Israel and Syria had allied. And this is why they were teaming up against Judah. They were trying to pull together an alliance of all of the nations in this area to try to hold off Assyria, and Judah, for whatever reason, had refused to go along with it. And since Judah wouldn't contribute voluntarily, they were going to do what they could to take this country by force so that they had their troops, so that they had their resources to try to keep the Assyrians off their necks. And so how does Ahaz want to solve this problem? Big, cruel, conquering empire over here. Couple closer countries, one of them your cousins, who are trying to fight off big, cruel empire. Who's the real problem here? Well, he's focused on these two. How is he going to solve it? By allying with the bad guys. I mean, this is as if you read in your morning paper a pronouncement from the government of Israel that they have decided that Lebanon is just too much of a problem, and so they're going to help Al-Qaeda take it over. That's about the magnitude of what we have going on here. So you can understand why Isaiah blows up at him. And in response, Isaiah tells Ahaz God is still going to give him a sign, but it's not going to be good. And I don't know if you caught it on the way by. When Isaiah goes to him first, he says, your God is going to take care of you. Now he says, my God will give you a sign. God has withdrawn himself from the king. And so he says, there's going to be a sign for you. A virgin will give birth to a son. And before he's grown up, Israel and Syria will be destroyed. Now, at first glance, you might think that sounds good. But compare. Compare. You look at what he says in verse 15 and following. Then look back at verse 8, where he says, within 65 years, Ephraim will no longer be a people. They'll be shattered. 65 years in which the northern kingdom of Israel would continue to be there as a buffer and a bulwark against the Assyrians. 65 years that they would hold this empire off the backs of the people of Judah. But now that timeline's been moved up. Assyria is going to roll over Syria, and they're going to roll over Israel and come flooding down and bring disaster on Judah. The nation will be spared from complete conquest, but only by the skin of their teeth. It will come down to the point that Jerusalem is the only thing left that Assyria hasn't taken. And this is the tipping point for the dynasty of David. Because from here on, while Judah will continue to exist for a century and more, they will no longer truly be an independent nation. David's descendants from here on out will rule under the shadow and under the thumb of pagan empires. This is the darkness into which the promise of Isaiah 9 is spoken. This is the human failure that God promises to redeem. A weak and foolish king chose to put his trust in war and his own ability to make war to protect his own life and power. And in so doing, he's betrayed the trust of his people. He has brought disaster on the nation and led it into the valley of the shadow of death. But in his time, God will shine a great light in that deadly darkness. He will light the way and lead his people out. He will give them a new king, a descendant of David who will be everything that Ahaz wasn't, and who will bring about everything that Ahaz couldn't. Indeed, this new king will be perfect, because while he will be fully and humbly human, he will also be far more. He will be God. And Isaiah had no doubt about that. The titles, the language that's used could never in conscience be applied to anyone merely human. This is completely out of the context of anything that was ever said about the kings of Israel or the kings of Judah, even at their greatest moments. And so the child is born, delivered by his mother just like any other baby, with dirty diapers and runny noses, just like any other child. The son is given, sent by God to redeem his people, to do what no mere human could do. And not in the adult way of politics and power games and crushing the opposition, but in the way that a newborn changes your heart. The way of weakness. And as John Oswalt of Asbury puts it, this shows us the central paradox in Isaiah's conception of Yahweh's deliverance of his people. How will God deliver from arrogance, war, oppression, and coercion? By being more arrogant, more warlike, more oppressive, and more coercive? Surely the book of Isaiah indicates frequently that God was powerful enough to destroy his enemies in an instant. Yet again and again, when the prophet comes to the heart of the means of deliverance, a childlike face peers out at us. God is strong enough to overcome his enemies by becoming vulnerable, transparent, and humble. The only hope, in fact, for turning enmity into friendship. And again, it's important to understand that this child king who is promised will be no less than God among us. He will be the ultimate fulfillment of the promise of Emmanuel, the one who fulfilled that sign as it should have been. Because only God could merit these four great names in verse 6. And the people of Israel didn't make mistakes about that. And so, having taken some time this morning to set the stage, I'd like to begin with the first of these names to see what they have to tell us. And the first name that Isaiah gives, I should say first off, is just one name. You'll sometimes have people who think it should be split into two, and that unfortunately goes back to, at least just as far as I know, to a rather unfortunate strand in biblical scholarship that was trying to make this not about God by linking it to Egyptian practices and all of that, and it made about as much sense as it probably sounds. But no, it's very clear from the way that this passage is structured that this is one name, that these two terms belong together. And unfortunately, English, with this traditional translation, Wonderful Counselor, English doesn't really do us any favors here, just because the way the language has evolved since the translators of the King James, gave us this particular phrase 500 years ago, or 400 years ago, excuse me. Because nowadays, wonderful, it just means neato, spiffy, anything that gets you excited. And a counselor, while a figure we appreciate, is nevertheless a very human figure. And there's probably more than one of us here who has talked about having a wonderful counselor at some point along the way, someone who has helped us work through a particularly difficult issue. But this is not what Isaiah is talking about. Though I would note this, we don't put it this way, but when we go to counselors, we go to them for wisdom. For wisdom for our lives, for the decisions that we have to face. And so the nub of that idea is still there. But Isaiah, of course, is talking about something much, much larger. Much larger than that. Wonderful, in this passage, means miraculous, supernatural. Something which can only be explained by God. So the child born to us, the son who is given, will give counsel which is wise beyond any human wisdom. Which is, in fact, the pure wisdom of God. And the contrast here with Ahaz is stark. As Ahaz turned away from the wisdom of God to act with supernatural foolishness, a folly straight from the pit of hell. And by his folly, he brought disaster on his family and on his nation. A disaster so great that to redeem it, to fulfill the promises of God, would take wisdom greater than that of Solomon. For as we've noted, even Solomon fell into folly in the end. It would take wisdom which is perfect and eternal. As the British Old Testament scholar J. Alec Mateer has written, the decisions of a king make or break a kingdom. And a kingdom designed to be everlasting demands a wisdom like that of the everlasting God. in this case, like God, because he is God. And that the decisions of a king make or break a kingdom, the decisions of a president make or break a nation. Certainly, it doesn't take much of a look through human history, recent or otherwise, to recognize that. That nations are raised up by the wisdom of their founders and then fail and falter as that wisdom dies out and eventually die by their folly. That's why Psalm 146 says, "Put not your trust in princes, in mortal men who cannot save." Because even the best of them will die, and the best of what they have will not remain behind them, will not continue. But we have a king whose wisdom is perfect and unfailing. We have a Lord for our lives whose wisdom is perfect and unfailing. We can trust him. We can trust him with the decisions we have to make today. We can trust him with all of life. We can trust him for the future, no matter how bleak the present might sometimes seem to us. Because he is to us, for the whole world, the perfect wisdom of God, our salvation, our holiness, and our peace. Let's pray.